My name is Jesse Maroney, and I am 37 years of age. And today's date is Monday, April 26, 2021. And I'm located in Anaheim, California, at the Islamic Institute of Orange County. The name of my recording partner is obviously Anthony McDuffie, otherwise known as Bomani. And he is a friend of mine. He is somebody that I met also too through the organization that I work with, Link Outside, and has become a very good partner and teacher to me as well.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen. My name is Anthony McDuffie, also known as Bomani. My age is 34. The date is Monday, April 26, 2001. I am located in Long Beach, California. The name of my recording partner is Jesse Maroney. Mm-hmm. The relationship between me and him is him being my spiritual mentor and also brother in faith and friend.
Okay, so alhamdulillah, all praise is due to God, and we start in the name of God and with the blessings and the peace upon the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. So we are here with dear friend Anthony McDuffie. I like to call him Bomani through the course of this talk, just because that's how I know him as Bomani. So we obviously met through Link Outside, right, which is a Muslim prison outreach program that kind of tries to serve some of the spiritual needs of different individuals who are in the incarcerated spaces in the United States of America. But what I want to do is I kind of want to get into kind of what led up to the incarceration and some different life experiences that you had prior to that, to give people context of kind of how you got into that place and then what some of the fruits that actually came out of that experience and how it has kind of made you into the man you are today and some of the path that you're kind of going on now, and also to what it kind of meant overall to find some different mentors and different figures with inside of those spaces to help guide you along the process. So, okay, so if you could just give me a little bit about where'd you grow up, man, Bomani?
I grew up in South Los Angeles, South Central Los Angeles. My parents grew up in South Central Los Angeles, also in Compton and Watts. So we're very centralized in those areas. My upbringing, living in South Los Angeles, was pretty much the typical of a young Black kid. The environment was very poverty-stricken. It was very violent. It was very hostile. Our conditions was poor, although our parents made their best to provide food for the household. My mother have a collective of 9 children. I'm the middle child.
How old is the oldest, if you don't mind me asking?
The oldest is probably 46 or 45.
Okay.
And he's currently in prison. He's been in prison probably about 26 years now.
Wow, 26 years.
Yeah, that's my oldest brother.
Okay. If you don't mind me asking, if you want to, how many people are incarcerated in your family?
With the family of my mother, right? My mother's children.
Yeah,
right?
Mother's side, yeah.
Currently, it's 2.
2. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah.
Okay. And what was the name of the, before we kind of get into a little bit more about the family history, what was the name of the area that you grew up in Los Angeles? Was it like a name for it?
They called it the Adams Crenshaw district, but then also too, it's called West Adams, right? So in Crenshaw district, you also have the district of West Adams, and so that's pretty much like in the near Crenshaw, I think it's but south or west of Crenshaw, and yeah, we centralized in that area for a long time up in my upbringing. However, we wasn't just there for the majority of my life, because Section 8, what Section 8 housing does is that in order for you to qualify for the housing and be a recipient of it, you have to like live by certain guidelines of Section 8. So we were frequently moving, sometimes to the valley, sometimes, but we wouldn't stay there long. So it'd be like maybe a year that we have to move back to LA and so on and so forth. Yeah. So.
Okay. And so you grew up in a household that initially had your mom and your dad, right?
Initially, yes.
Yes. And then that kind of broke off.
Yes, that broke off. So I was living with my mother and my father up and all the way up until the age of 8 years old. My father at that point died from diabetes. And when he died, it pretty much broke into family structure, family household. And so what my mother winded up doing is finding, well, she had boyfriends, but I felt like she was trying to find a replacement. These replacements weren't suitable. So she was just kind of like, if you will, just in and out of relationships with different men.
Gotcha. Okay. And so what did that begin to do to your psyche when that began to happen, if you don't mind explaining that a little bit?
Yeah. So my father growing up, I was more attached to my father than my mother. I was a daddy's boy. I was his first son. And yeah, my father was my protector. He was pretty much like my hero. He was like my provider. He did most of everything for me and kind of like catered to me because I was his firstborn. So I was pretty much like, if you will, spoiled in that sense. So when he died, there's like a emotional break and a emotional separation between me and my mother. And then also there was this sense of trauma because, when he died, it was kind of like a family secret. Initially, they didn't want to tell me he was paralyzed and he was in the hospital in a coma, due to his diabetes. So, they didn't want to tell me, but they had to because it was funeral arrangements. Yeah. So I knew then that he passed away and I saw him at the wake. And then they were trying to explain to me then what happened. But then the trauma already kind of like seeped into my psyche.
And gotcha.
Yeah.
So if I had to ask the question, was this something that was kind of normal in the community that you grew up in, meaning like that a lot of mothers were single and raising kids on their own? And if that was so to be the case in the community around you, what do you think contributed it to that actual reality?
So I think it was pretty normal. I seen a lot of households and my friends where they were growing up with just their mother. And I think the contributing factor to that was crime, also drugs. I think more than crime, drugs. And more than drugs, I think it was this this hyper-policing that was going on within the community as well. So drugs, crime, policing, and just like the dysfunctional or the breaking down of family structures all throughout the community contributed to single-parent households.
Mm. So can you give me some example of hyper-policing so that the people who are listening can kind of understand kind of what is an example of hyper-policing, especially in a situation where, you know, you're in South Central Los Angeles, where you're in a time frame when gangs are pretty rampant. Crime is kind of being actually fueled by a lot of different government policies and also to contra wars and all this different type of stuff that went on. But can you give me just some examples of the hyper policing?
Yeah, sure. So an example of hyper policing would be police presence within a day. You're seeing their presence within 2 to 3 hours of every 2 to 3 hours at a time where you're kind of just seeing them circling around, and then they're just like stopping people and frisking people, frequently asking questions, are you on probation, are you on parole? This sense of just watching you and hawk-eyeing you, and then just this sense of harassment where they're constantly just pulling you over, or they're constantly just watching your whereabouts or watching you. Literally, like, it was almost, it seemed as if it was a game where they just come out during their shifts and they look and they kind of like hunt down potential criminals or who they view as potential criminals. But what was interesting about it was all of these police that policed our communities, at least at the time when I grew up, were white. So we associated whites, and particularly white males and police, and we associated that with this sense of negativity. So it was, as early as I can remember, I was probably about the age of 9. I remember coming out my front house and I seen a police car parked in front of the house. And before then, I used to go to DARE programs. And DARE programs is like programs to kind of like deter kids to, you know, use drugs and et cetera and so forth. But what was vivid that I can remember in a DARE program was that if you saw a police officer, they would give you a baseball card. And so that's what I remember. And at that time, I was a collector of cards, of not just baseball cards, but all cards of sports. And so I seen a police officer parked in front of our house, and I walked up to the car and I asked them for a baseball card, but the window was rolled up. So two white officers, one in the passenger seat, he rolled down the window. And so I asked him for the baseball card. I'm like, can I have a baseball card? And he's like, a baseball card? And he looks at his partner, and then he looks back at me. And then he goes into the glove department, and he gives me a picture. And when I looked at a picture, it was two lynched slaves. And yeah, and so, and then I looked back at him, and he started laughing, and they drove off. So this sense of trauma, if you will, this sense of imposing fear upon kids, and particularly black kids, by local law enforcement, I feel like was the norm. And that was just a form that I experienced and kind of traumatized me all the way up until this day. So now, even to this day, I have this sense of distrust towards law enforcement, and I don't even approach them. You know, in fact, there's times where if I even see them, there's this sense of anxiety, and then I kind of just want to get out of their path, you know. So if they're right, then I want to turn left, and if they're left, and I want to turn right, and vice versa.
Gotcha. So, okay, so we have the factors of, obviously, father figure being absent. A lot of different families around you have experienced the same, and maybe not from a medical standpoint, but maybe more of a drug and just overall, like you said, hyper policing, also to extreme sentencing, getting a lot of African American males off of the streets and out of the homes. And then finally, so now at some point or another, you begin to look for some comfort or some places to fill that void, right? And so what did you find overall? What was your next direction that you went into? Was it, you know, to find that family, to find that, to fill that void?
Yeah, so once I detached from my mother, then that's when domestic violence was taking place a lot in the household. So my mom done a lot of abuse towards not just me, but also my other siblings. And it was just kind of like a repetitive thing. And at that time, she was going through so much things. And so that kind of contributed to her neglecting us and abusing us and kind of like creating this sense of hostility within the household. So I ran away. And when I was running away, I was seeking to run away to find that family support and that family security and that family love that I was lacking at home. And what I was doing was I was finding it in the street, and I was finding it in the households of my friends that I went to school with. And their moms were showing me that same love and security and safety that I was looking for. And my mom in our household, I was being shown at their household. So it just gave me more of an encouragement to run away. And once I ran away, I frequently ran into the streets. And then at that point, or at some point, we became more and more associated with the street and less associated with school. And at the early age of 11 and 12, we started to get jumped in gangs. And now the gang became this sense of family, and the gang became this sense of security and protection that I was looking for in a household and a family structure. Now it's now formed in the streets, and what our family is in the streets, and our brother and our coalition or brotherhood within the streets has now at this point became our family. And I became a member of it and created identity within a gang.
Gotcha. So what was your identity in the gang? Like what was, give me a typical quick breakdown of kind of what it is to be, what position you were, what it means to be a gang. What's a daily thing that you used to go through? What was, you know, what's a daily experience with, Bomani now, but what's a daily experience with you before as a gang member? What would be the daily experience?
Yeah, so first of all, in order to create an identity within a gang, you must be known for whatever your character traits are. So for instance, if before I joined the gang, I was good at selling cards, or I was good at selling candy, or I was good at selling, then typically my gang association or identity or name would be something similar to those characteristics. So I'll be like a Jay Hustle or something within the lines of that characteristic. Me in particular, I was growing up around a lot of individuals within a gang that was very violent. And we took on violent acts such as going to other schools and beating up other gang members, acts as carjackings, acts as robbing, you know, more violent acts. So because of these traits, and because I, you know, now identified myself with this violent group, I created a violent identity, and therefore was called by a more so violent name as Brazy or Brazen.
Okay, so as you graduate kind of and you get higher up in rank, you get actually more violent. That's a natural, that's a usual normal thing.
Well, actually, so what happens within a gang is all of us are violent from one stint or another. And how you rank up is by, like you said, how violent you are or how violent you become.
Gotcha.
So not everybody in a gang continues to be violent. So like I was describing at first, some gang members stick to their character traits, such as what I was describing as hustling. So they would continue to hustle as gang members and hustle for the benefit of the gang in that sense.
Okay.
But if you're, again, if you're associated and you're hanging around a more violent group, then 9 out of 10, your rank and degrees on climbing that rank depends on more violent acts. Gotcha. So the more violent acts you do, the higher the rank and the more respected you are within the gang.
All right. So, okay. So from 11 years old, you were obviously in a gang and things start to graduate. And overall, if you just briefly tell me, what's your school life like? Are you just playing any sports at this time, or are you, what are you doing, anything? Or are you just bouncing in and out of school? What's your relationship with just overall education?
So once you become a gang member, there is no school. The streets is school. You're learning street knowledge. So as far as the formal educational system, even if I am going to school to attend, it was more so for gang activity. It wasn't to attend to be a student, for one. And then for two, the educational system within Los Angeles was so broken that the teachers didn't give a damn whether you came to school to gang bang or not. They was just paid to be there and be present and teach a curriculum. So if you was disruptive and you was gang banging, then you was just disruptive and gang banging. They really didn't care one way or another.
So really no attention, no effort put into trying to kind of sway the younger crowd from going into those different gang activities, huh?
No, absolutely not.
Okay. All right. So now we understand your relationship with education. Now we're getting into what was your first run-in with the law like?
So again, being this gang member, I'm committing crimes every day. So eventually, I would get caught for the crime. So one of my first crimes I got caught for was a robbery. And I might have been about 12 or 13 years old. And I go to juvenile hall, and now I become introduced into the system. And this system of juvenile hall is somewhat of a system, kind of like, so what they associated with, or if I was to give an analogy, juvenile hall would be the equivalent of elementary. And then you would have like county jail or youth authority would be the equivalent of junior high school. And you will have county jail would be the equivalent of high school. And then you will have prison would be the equivalent of, you know, college, right? So that was kind of like the degrees of the system and how it pretty much just like propelled us and just pushed us through to graduate all the way up until the big house, which they consider to be prison, right? So, yeah, I was introduced at about 12, 13 years old, robbery. And then once you're inside juvenile hall, it's just this continuance cycle of, if you will, just reinforcing all of the negative behaviors, reinforcing all of the gang activity, reinforcing all of the trauma, creating more trauma. So you're just in this like cesspool and this vicious cycle of reinforcement of all of the negativity that you already been enduring before juvenile hall. You're just reinforcing it in juvenile hall.
Gotcha. And so finally you got a sentence to an adult term, right, at some point. And what was that for, if you don't mind me asking?
It was for attempted murder. So I was involved in a gang retaliatory gang shooting. One of our friends got murdered by a rival gang member, and I retaliated, you know, and in that retaliation, four people were shot, and I was 17 at the time, and I was sentenced as an adult to prison as a juvenile.
How much time were you given?
I was given 15 years in I was given 25 years in state prison and served 15 years.
Okay, so in that time frame, obviously we talked about you back and forth in the juvenile halls, youth academies, and whatnot, and obviously this was a place that didn't really have any real structure for rehabilitation, and you know, because I was in a place like that myself, where you're just basically around a bunch of young people trying to become better criminals a lot of times. Yeah. So, what was like? Okay. Now you're sitting down, you're in prison, you're in the big boy house, things have changed, and you're 17 years old. You got a nice little stretch that you got to do, a nice little time in prison that you got to do. It's not like a couple months no more, and then you're back home. Now you're going to sit down for a minute. What was your thought process at that point when you got that? Was there like a pivotal point? Was there like a changing point at this point of like, did it change how you thought? Or was it just like, okay, I'm got to just kind of keep going with the whole gang situation? You know, what was the pivotal? Can you give me just a little glimpse into the introductory into that when you were actually given 25 years? Right. Now it's actually real. The gavel is hit. Boom. You're given 25 years. What was that? What was that like for you right then?
Man, it was tough. My thought patterns was like 25 years. I probably would never see the life again. Like I couldn't imagine myself serving 25 years at 17. So that long lengthy sentence in my head registered as a life sentence. It was no different. I didn't see the difference between 25 and life, because the sentence was so lengthy. So at that point it was just like, my life's over. My life's over. There's no reason to live or to rehabilitate or to even try to want to live and rehabilitate. So I went into this shut off period where I just shut off everything out in the outside world, and then just kind of focused in more to what was going on inside. So I became, if you will, just more violent inside of these systems, and I became more smarter as well, because I started to live and see and experience how people were kind of like getting themselves killed and what they were getting themselves killed over. So it was a reality that I had to face, that I had to grow up in really quick. So at 17, I grew up to be 20, 25 overnight, you know? And now I'm in this mindset of survival. So now I'm thinking about, okay, I'm going to prison. How am I going to survive in prison? So the first thing I'm thinking was weaponry. So I'm learning how to sharpen knives in order to defend myself. People around me were a lot older, so they were a lot more familiarized with the prison and the prison system. So they're educating me and giving me information and also knowledge as to survive the system of prison. So I'm reading books such as Art of War, Sun Tzu, at 18 years old, and I'm working out constantly. And this is the program: workout, read war, politic of war, and inflict violence and harm.
So what was the changing point? How did you get introduced? Because, you know, Islam is your religion, and you're an active practicing Muslim. So what was the point where, how did you meet Islam, or how did Islam meet you? Where, how did that whole thing manifest to you? How did it come into your life? And then what did it begin to do after that? Once you know, because you're in this mindset you're talking about pretty much is just like go mode. You're all in. You know, you're just completely acclimating to this, to the place around you, and the place around you is basically calling for violence and all this stuff. But what was the changing point? What softened your heart to listening maybe to the teachings of Islam and whatnot?
Honestly, I was around about 25, 26. I was in Calipatria State Prison. Calipatria, there's really nothing to do. That, as far as the educational system at that time, was getting your GED. And they had one class, and the class had a limit, I believe, of 25 people in order to get on this class. And that's pretty much it. You have that, and then you have NAAA, and then they have like a list of 35, right? Now, take into account that this is a yard where you probably have about 1,000 people on a yard, but yet you have a waiting list of, you know, of people trying to get into a class that has a capacity of 25 people. So the waiting list is just like, I would never get in class, right? So the idea was for you to stay on the yard, be on the yard, and then do as they do on the yard, which is work out, politic, and inflict violence and harm. So I got to the point where it's like, oh man, I'm just tired of this. I'm tired of politicking. You know, we politicked on those yards every day. We're politicking. We're thinking of ways of how to manipulate this, or how to manipulate that person, how to get this person stabbed, how to get that person stabbed, how to create a riot, or when we do create a riot, who we want to kill. So we watch people, literally watch people and observe them days and weeks and months, and learn their strengths and learn their weaknesses and learn who they talk to and who associate and learn the point. So we're literally just studying people to one day, if it ever happens, I'm going to kill this person. This is how I'm going to kill them. So this is the thought pattern. And then it just got repetitive. And I'm just like, man, you know what? This is too much. This is like, I need something else. So what happened was they started to do a sign-up list for Arabic class. I'm like, oh, okay. Finally, something different. I want to learn a different language. I was always the type of person who wanted to learn and expand my vocabulary, expand my mind, expand my vision, expand. So I'm like, all right, I'll sign up for Arabic class. Now, mind you, at this time, I had no intentions on being a Muslim at all. In fact, I thought against it. Like, nah, like, you know, these people are this way and that way, and they think this way. I was just anti-religion, period. And so I went into Arabic class, and with the intentions on just learning a new language. But I didn't know that the Arabic was connected to Islam. And then the instructor who was teaching the Arabic class was Muslim. So it was just no way around being exposed to Islam, right? So as I continued to go to class and learn Arabic, I became fascinated by the language. I became fascinated by the expression of the language. I became fascinated at the depth of the language. And this is what kind of pulled me in to learning about and exploring Islam more. And so it was actually that opened my heart and opened my curiosity to even want to look into it. And then once I did look into it, I realized it was suiting. And I realized it was a calling of my soul, of my spirit. And so naturally after that part, it was just a process then of just kind of like getting myself out of gang culture and embracing Islam. And then finally I got into the point where I had the strength of doing it. But that wasn't easy. You know, that's a whole nother conversation we can have. But
well, if you could break down maybe in about 3 minutes, just give me just a little bit of that process. Give me, because we want to know a little bit about, especially being Muslim in prison and some of the, you know, the pull that now, obviously you're making the shift from one tribal culture to a whole nother lifestyle almost, you know what I mean? Yeah. And so can you just give me just a quick, like a brief glimpse? Because I know that's a long conversation.
It really is a long conversation. But if I was to give you like a synopsis of that process. So basically, I'm caught in a political affiliation. I'm a blood. Muslims in prison, although Muslims are considered to be a religion in prison, but it's also a political entity. Muslims have their own political interests in prison. So to become a Muslim and be part of a blood tribe was a conflict of interest politically. So I'm battling two forces, because now it's like, okay, if I wanted to become Muslim and practice religion, then now I suffer the consequences, political consequences, of now dropping one affiliation and tying myself to a whole nother political affiliation in prison. And in prison, that's pretty much a no-no. So that was the process that I had to go through, and it wasn't an easy process. However, I got to the point where I was reputable enough in the Damu tribe where they was allowing me to somewhat denounce the affiliation and practice the religion.
So the Damu tribe is like a section of bloods, right? That's the overall blood gang, or what?
So in prison, Damu blood is all one tribe. It's all one community. It's all one political entity.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. And so, okay. So now, can you explain to me also to, how Islam a little bit balanced you, but also to give me a little bit of your explanation or your experience in the dog program that's actually presented at the facility that you were last at.
Definitely. Islam was speaking contrary, and then it kind of like gave me knowledge that was speaking contrary to my living experience of a gang member. So Islam was teaching me how to purify my character and how to be dignified and how to treat others. So this was the shift. This was the positive shift. This was the focal point. This was the pivotal moment in the change of my development, because now I'm going from, you know, being this awful person who's having this apathy for people, having this sense of like disconnect from humanity, to now connecting myself with humanity and having empathy instead of apathy. And now, spreading love, or at least being willing to receive love and then reciprocate that and give love at the same time. So now it's a paradigm shift within my own being.
Okay.
So that's the Islamic part. And then,
so would you say the dog program? Yeah. So would you say the dog program? You know what? Just real quickly, if you could just explain what the dog program is first.
Yeah. So Pause for Life was a program I was introduced to, Lancaster, Eddy Yard, around 2000, I believe, like 2018, 17. And it was just a program to further rehabilitate the inmates there, give inmates a assignment to do, more so a a job of humanity to do to rehabilitate rescue dogs and bring these dogs into the institution who were otherwise would have been put down and and killed and euthanized, and giving them the opportunity at being rehabilitated and then going back out into the community and being house dogs to a beautiful home. So that was our job. Our job was to rehabilitate these animals and give them a home.
Great. So that was very therapeutic overall. So what did it also to mean to now that also, you know, the in-prison visits that Link Outside, the organization that I'm a part of, what did that mean to actually have somebody come in who had, because obviously, especially in prison, if, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, there's not too much of a Islamic presence from the outside community at all, really helping the individuals who have accepted Islam. Am I right or am I wrong? Well, in your experience, I should say.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You're definitely right. Because even though I was a Muslim in prison, I still felt like we was disconnected to the outside Muslim community. So gotcha. What Link Outside did was bridge that. It bridged that gap. It bridged that disconnect and connected us to the community outside and gave us the opportunity to kind of have like this sense of like, oh, okay, we're not rejected, but we actually are accepted, and we are accepted in the bigger and broader world of the Islamic community. And so that gave us this sense of like connection, gave this sense of prosperity, gave us this sense of hope, actually. Gotcha. Gave us this sense of well-being.
So also too, what would you say, what were some of the highlights of actually having somebody connect with you that wasn't just from the Muslim community, but also to had lived experience that had been formerly incarcerated himself? What did that mean? What has that done overall, not just for your incarceration part, but now that you're back in society, what has that overall done for you, if you had to put it, formulate it in words?
Yeah, just contribute to my well-being, and then gave me this sense of relatability. You know, I was relating to these, you know, individuals such as yourself, who was part of this organization, who was kind of like giving me this living shared experience and reality of connecting. Yeah, so that's what it did. It actually just contributed to the well-being of my overall health.
And so what has your first, because we're in the month of Ramadan here for anybody who's going to be listening to this, because this is historical, right? So we're in the month of Ramadan in 2021, and this is like your real, because COVID was last year, so you didn't really get to experience too much of the community. What has your experience been so far with the Islamic community here in Southern California during Ramadan? What has been some highlights? What's been some clarifications? What's been some eye openers, or whatever that you would have to say about it?
I think one of the highlights is acceptance. I felt accepted by the larger Islamic community, especially when this larger Islamic community can be of different ethnicities. And as a Black man, I always felt that even being Muslim, I was rejected because of me being Black. So it was the sense of acceptance that I received and then I got, and then also the sense of giving back in charity, which was an act of kindness that I feel like contributed to, you know, my mental health and my spiritual health.
That's good. Okay, so we have just a couple minutes left. Is there any like closing remark you want to make, or any, you know, certain, I don't know, advice you want to give? Because obviously this is going to be, you know, jotted down, so other people are going to listen to this. So if there's some piece of advice, or there's something that you will want to leave, you know, as some type of memorabilia, or I should say as a note, what would you like to say?
I would like to say, don't give up on the young Black boys and give them hope, you know, and you give them hope by connecting. So proximity is a very, very important instrumental tool when it comes to dealing with Black youth. Be proximate, be close, help, connect. That's what I have to say.
Okay. All right. So I think it was a really good interview. You gave some great highlights on just in general the process of kind of what goes on in the psyche of especially a young Black male growing up in a very poverty-stricken, violent, especially during that time, violent area. Some of the choices that are, you know, there's not really too many choices when you grow up in those situations. And so the only last remark that I can say is that, you know, you continue to amaze me in just your abilities, you know, and that even out of those really wild situations, there's a ton of gems that can be developed with inside of an individual. That's all I have to say.
So I just wanted to ask you, as you're reflecting on all of these experiences that you've been through, what do you wish people knew about you that you feel like they don't?
I wish people knew that I'm this person that's open, that's understanding, that's kind, that's giving, that's honest, that's sincere. And I felt like a lot of people didn't get a chance to know that part of me because they closed themselves down to me because of what they saw, perception. Perception blocked them from getting to know the beautiful person that I am.
That's great. And what are you proudest of that you've done or accomplished in your life so far?
Getting here, freedom, being with you and having this interview. I could have been in prison. Yeah, literally still with 10 years. So yeah, just being here, being free, living, being amongst beautiful people of all faith, of all nationalities, creeds, and backgrounds. And being in that positive space and relishing in every moment of this beautiful freedom. So, yeah.
That's great. Thanks.
You're welcome.